Episode 2 of Season 17. I was listening to a podcast or something. Somebody mentioned in the podcast some service or system that I should look into. And I was driving with hands-free, and my phone was actually screen was off. So I'm thinking about this. I'm like, well, what's the best way to provide the show notes? Because the truth is, I'm going to finish that podcast. And after I finish that podcast, my podcast software auto-deletes the last file that I listened to. And I want it to do that because I'm done.
Right.
I could go back to my podcasts, find the podcast I listened to, visit their site, find the show notes page they have probably with all the data on their site. But for one little lookup, I'm not going to do that. However, if I was in my inbox and I got the notes from this week's episode of blah, 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 it might be useful to then be able to click around and see things. So I thought, you know what we should do is we should take the GeekSpeak show pages that we create and spit them out in a newsletter form, an email form, every week.
Why not RSS? Do you have an RSS feed for the actual show notes?
Well, the show notes are part of the RSS feed that is the podcast. So if you subscribe to the podcast through an RSS feed, yeah, you'd have them.
Okay. So one of my favorite bloggers, technical bloggers, is Michael Tsai. And 90% of what he does is clip out important snippets on a certain topic from multiple authors and make a single blog post out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes he'll add his own commentary.
And how do you read him?
Well, through RSS, through a...
Through an RSS feed. Yeah.
So, but I really like the way he does it because I'm getting the information he thinks is important. And he's not really saying much of his own stuff, but he's doing all the work. And it's the most analogous thing I've seen to our bits.
Our show notes.
Right.
It is true that right now you could subscribe to our podcast via a news reader and you would get our bits. That is totally true. Have you tried that with your news reader?
I haven't tried that, no.
It's geekspeak.org/shows/rss.xml.
And this is the same feed that the podcast players use.
Yeah, the only thing that's different about the podcast feed is an RSS has an enclosure tag with a media file in it.
Right.
So it's one extra element per for a podcast item.
Yeah, but how you expose that to users is different. I mean, you don't have a link on the site, do you?
Well, we have a podcast linked to the site. But the thing is, you as a user who reads stuff...
Me as a reader.
I don't know if you represent most people. But it's true that if people
Are we talking to most people?
I don't know. We're talking to the, you know, 1,500 people that subscribe to GeekSpeak, I guess. So my thought was, if you'd like to get a weekly email from us, every time I publish a show, an email that says, the show's up, and here are all the notes, which of course are part of the rich content feed that we have and on the website, all of them are kind of contained, I can email out that and put it on mailing list. I'll use like MailChimp or something. So if you're interested in that, please let us know and I'll get going on it.
Send us an email.
Send us an email because you use email.
It's pretty funny. I've been hearing a lot about email lists lately, which is kind of bizarre because it's so 20 years ago.
It feels like it, doesn't it?
But there's a lot of organizations, a lot of tech groups that seem to be using that more and more.
You know, a year ago, I switched from JavaScript working here and switched to Objective-C. Mm-hmm. And I'm still on all the mailing lists for JavaScript. One mailing list I'm on for JavaScript. Every time it comes through, even though I'm not coding every week I read that thing. I just read the headlines, you know, and it kind of feels like it keeps me abreast of things. You know, I know there's now a competitor to React that's a little faster. You know, like the stuff that I'm kind of curious about, just enough to get a snippet of it.
And you now know that JavaScript has just as many build tools as Objective-C does.
Much more, actually, because Objective-C has one. It's not a very good IDE.
But, come on. Give AppCode
Should I give Xcode a,
no,
a break?
No, AppCode. There's a second one.
Is it any good?
I haven't used it, but I'm here for TDD, guys. It's great.
Are you test-driven?
No.
No. This week I've just been writing, updating our framework so that we can actually do some more tests. And I'm doing it for a group I'm not even part of because I use their code a lot. And it's been kind of exciting to, in the stand-up today, I said, I'm just working on functional tests for you guys. And everyone's like, oh, pretty. Like, clearly there's a desire for it. It's always useful. But, you know,
As
long as someone else does it, it's really useful. Okay. Does our RSS feed show up in your feed reader? I got to know this. This is driving me crazy.
Okay. Where's the plus button? Here it is. Let's put this in here. So geekspeak.org/shows/RSS.xml. And yes, it is in there. Let's put that under tech.
I'm Lyle Troxell. And with me in the air room is Mr. Brian Young. He's an iOS developer with an expertise at Swift, looking for work in the field of programming, but also very happily employed for a company that does database application development tools.
Yeah, they make a whole IDE and development environment built around a database.
And you do development and marketing for them.
I do indeed.
So you are a broad spectrum kind of person.
I am a jack of all trades.
And your Twitter handle is Brian C. Young. Twitter, and I am Lyle, L-Y-L-E. And this week, Brian, I think I'm going to get to 1,000 followers. I'm so excited.
Oh, you're mentioning this just so you do get to 1,000 followers.
I'm hoping that someone out there that's not following me has a Twitter account or wants to make one bumps me up from the 999 that's been there for a few days.
And then you're going to have to learn all about how many robots you have following you.
You know, there are a lot of robots out there. And I have, in the last year, been kind of not accepting them or blocking them when they follow me because, you know, who really wants it? But I'm sure it's a lot of cruft. That's true. And I'm embarrassed by my own egotistical desire to have that number be high. So I acknowledge that fact. Moving on.
I was playing around with my Google Home. We've talked about it a couple times over the last few weeks. And when I first set it up, I tried to play GeekSpeak. I said, Google Home. Actually, I shouldn't say that, right? I said, jibble blah blah.
You said initiation play word for Google's voice command
word.
System.
Initiation word, computer. That's it. We'll use computer. Computer, play GeekSpeak with Lyle Troxell. And it just said, I don't know what GeekSpeak is. 2 days ago, I tried it again, and magically, it knows what GeekSpeak by Lyle Troxell is.
That's interesting. So I'm assuming that Google is using its podcasting service, which I did sign us up for, even though I'm a little I don't like the way they're doing it. The way that iTunes has done indexing of podcasts since the very beginning is it's just an aggregator, a search engine system. And what it does is as people put in podcast feeds into iTunes, it takes that same link, it does a check on its service level, indexes it, and then it will crawl and hit every RSS feed that it has daily or something like that, maybe more frequently. I'm not really sure the details. And then that engine is available for people to subscribe to and search through. Additionally, they surface an API to be able to look through their database. So it's kind of like a pretty friendly environment. But the most important thing about it is that the RSS file never actually gets served by them, and neither does the audio files. So they are just a pointing service, a search engine service, like Google traditionally is. When Google launched their podcasting system, which I did add our feed to, they actually scrape the content and host it themselves. This has a couple benefits. One is that it's a lot faster in the sense that Google is just going to have a better performance machine and infrastructure than we have with our one, you know, DigitalOcean instance to host the site. And Google can also do a whole bunch of really cool statistics on it. Find out how many people subscribe to your podcast, or their podcast, I should say. But the big thing about it is you no longer control. So it's not the way that I like it. Having control completely is not as important as having lots of listeners. And if more people find it, great. I'm assuming the Google Home product actually uses that search index.
Yeah, I would expect so.
And most likely when you did that search, with that vocal search, it looked, it didn't have it all set up. And then that came across as algorithmically as a problem, and it figured it out and solved it. It might be completely learning as it goes. It could be also that somebody tried to go a little deeper, and then their ability to go deeper to check it out actually caused the system to function correctly.
So recently, did you change the metadata?
No.
Based around?
No. Not in the last. No, I haven't changed metadata for a long time.
Okay.
Yeah. I did do some work to get Amazon's to work. To get podcasts to work, you have to have an index somewhere, right, to search against. It's not like you can just ask the ether. You have to ask something. So iTunes is one of those indexes. And there's another one that Amazon uses. They have a system like that too. And we were in there, but we were in there as GeekSpeak, KWSP. And since our name is no longer GeekSpeak, KWSP, I changed the name to be something, something, something. And now you can search for it. I think you just say trigger word for the Amazon thing. Listen to most recent episode of GeekSpeak. Please try it out. Let me know if it worked. It worked for me, but you might have to say more of the phrase. Adding Lyle Troxell might work. I'm not sure.
It helped with Google.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Some more follow-up, because I'm not sure whether everybody realizes, because I don't know if they're using a more modern podcast player, but you've been putting images in for each of the chapters that you've been laboriously breaking up the show into.
This is why the show goes late every week. Yes.
And last week, you actually referred to the image that if you had that modern podcast player, you could see it. And you made a funny comment, which made me think of something I had seen that I wanted to show you. And I'm going to force you to put this into the chapter markers this week, so you can't give up on
it this week. First off, let me just mention, last week was, or 2 weeks ago, was a show with you and I. And I put a whole bunch of content in into the feed, including pictures of you in, because I mentioned that you were in Lord of the Rings. And so maybe it was just last week's episode. I can't remember.
No, it's been two episodes.
So when I went searching for it, you gave me a clip of your, what is it called, reel? And it was like a low quality reel access.
Yes, I was an extra in Lord of the Rings. So what do you do when you're an extra in like a super big movie like that? As soon as you get a copy, you get images from it.
Yeah.
Well, the first copy I got, remember how old Lord of the Rings is now? Two Towers.
Yeah.
The first copy I got was a VHS screener copy for Hollywood screeners.
Oh, I see. Right.
So I grabbed the images off that. And when the DVD came out and the Blu-ray came out and the internet filled up with images, I never went back to get a high quality copy. So
of course I was motivated to find it. The entire scene that you're in, which is the storming of Helm's Deep. So when the orcs actually run up the parapet, you're one of the archers that takes them out.
Right.
And
watch closely, because just a little while later, the wall blows up and I'm pretty sure I was there.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't look for that one. But it was hard to recognize you. I asked my kids and my son, Wyatt, oh, that's Brian right there. I'm like, okay. And then when you kind of got back, you're like, yeah, I'm on the left. I'm like, okay, that's Brian. But the fun thing.
So Wyatt was right.
Wyatt was totally right. Totally knew you. I mean, that's the thing about kids, right? The family members, they know, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
In doing this, I was able to find like a really fun GIF. I like made GIFs of you. Like I spent way too much time making all this. So I do urge you to go back to a couple episodes ago. That was the zero episode of season 17. And you can see a whole GIF of Brian at the Helm's Deep fighting off the orc. Which, by the way, spoiler alert. They lost the battle. So.
And I died. I always wanted to make a fan page for the elf that died on there. Okay, so you mentioned in the last show, you were talking about the electric VW bus.
Yes.
That is supposedly coming out. And you looked at the image and you said, surely that's a rendering.
Yes.
And yeah, I mean, if you look at it, it absolutely looks like a rendering. But it reminded me of this photographer who went back. Now, in computer graphics, there's always these exercises that have been done since the early days of computer graphics to show what a renderer can do. These are basic reflections and basic materials.
You take a cube and put wood on it and put it in a space. And yeah, I'm looking at the same picture you are.
Yeah, so this photographer went back and he made four still lives exactly the way a computer graphics rendering would be. But if you scroll down.
They're real objects.
Those are real objects with a real setup, even distorted. This is the classic Utah teapot distorted. And cut off. And
so did he do 3D printing of these objects to make them look the way they are?
He must have with the
oh my God, this is life teapot. Imitating art, isn't it?
Yeah. So don't be so sure.
Okay. All right. So of course it's radio. So what you want to do is probably visit our show page for this today's AA. And if you have a good podcast player, I will put some images in there. And the image I'm going to put in there is the square wood block, the crystal sphere and the white marble cone, which by the way feels like every time I've ever done a render since the first time I was able to do 3D rendering on a computer, which by the way this would have taken 7 days to render on my first Mac.
Ray tracing, baby.
Babe, man, it's got some severe qualities to that nature. In any case, this image will be in the podcast feed if you've got a good podcast feed. And if not, you can just click from there to go to our show notes page and we'll link to it. Really cool that that's an actual image and not a 3D rendering.
Yeah, I got a kick out of it. I hope you did too.
Yeah, fantastic. I kind of want to just look at it more to see these thumbprints.
Well, and that's just it. People have worked in computer graphics for years to get that roughness, that lifelike quality. But to go in the reverse and try to polish something and remove reflections, everything except for what is in limited scene is impressive.
One of the things that this is great is that wood square, wood cube. The corners, the top, where it fades off to darkness, really dark, you see how the edge is kind of light, as in the mask doesn't completely cover the surface?
As in the veneer is slightly raised.
Well, except that, of course, it's intentional to make it look like it's not completely solid because it's a rendering with multiple spheres, safe surfaces. Or it's a mistake.
No, I'll keep talking about it if you keep doing this, but nobody can see it. Anyways, just notice how the grain of the two different sides don't match up.
I know. It's great. Oh, perfect. Oh, and the the teapot one is fantastic. Okay. Let's move on because this is horrible radio. All right, Brian.
No, this is a great thing for podcast players that can see the image.
I read this entire article a couple weeks ago when it came out, and I'm glad we're covering it on GeekSpeak. So please tell me all about Shazam, would you?
I'm going to go into Shazam, but I'm going to broaden this a little bit at first, because I was looking at an article. We talked a lot about fake news and about Facebook, and I believe we covered when they announced that they are going to start putting little markers on on news to show that this is in dispute.
Right.
Is that the terminology they use?
I don't know what they're calling exactly. Yeah. But the idea is to bring attention that this could be potentially not true.
Right.
Which is exactly what we wanted them to do at some level.
It is. And we talked about that at length. And there's an article that I stumbled on which talks about some things that we've known for a long time as well, which is about our memory. And this article goes on about how labeling things as fake news is not going to work because, principally, people don't remember the source of what they read. They principally don't remember the details of what they read. They remember a general statement. And looking back, even if you've read false things multiple times and at the time knew they were false, you may not keep that memory of the falsehood going forward.
And in fact, that little – you can kind of think of like that one little bit that says whether it's true or false is not the most important part. And so as the memory degrades, that's the part that's lost.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's decades of research that goes into this. And this article talking specifically about fake news is a great primer for that. And I'd like everyone to take a chance to go to our site and look at it. But in that context, I want to talk about memory. And it's a lot harder to talk about politics where everybody's charged up about it.
Yeah, let's avoid that.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about movies. And this story...
Yeah, no one has any emotions about movies.
Nobody has emotions about movies. At least nobody has partisan emotions about movies. And this one kind of hits home, and I'll tell you why later. There are people out there that have memories of a movie. And they discuss this. It goes back to a Yahoo Answers thing in 2009 where somebody posed a question about a movie they remember
seeing. Where'd this movie go kind of thing?
Well, they remember this movie from the 90s, and they were asking, I'm trying to find this thing, and I just can't seem to find it. Does anybody know? And he mentions the word Shazam. And at the same time, a couple years later, there was this group that was talking about the Berenstain Bears book. You're a father. You know about the kids' book, The Berenstain Bears.
Yes.
Well, apparently there's a bunch of people out there that were absolutely sure it was spelled a different way in their childhood. They're looking at the books now, and it has a different spelling than...
And they're like, oh, they changed the name of that book. I wonder why.
Yeah, and they started looking into why the spelling changed. And it became a big conspiracy theory, actually. And this was in 2011. And people got so riled up about the Berenstain Bears and the change in the spelling between an E and an A that... they started talking about something called the Mandela effect around this little community of Berenstain Bear conspiracy theorists.
What's the Mandela effect?
So Mandela, as in Nelson Mandela, there was a period back in the 80s or 90s that people were sure that he died in prison. And this thought has been carried forward. Well, people who believe in this...
So at one point... So of course, Mandela was famously put in prison because of his peaceful standing up against the apartheid in South Africa,
right?
And he becomes this kind of mentor, and more. And some people think that he actually passes away in prison. And for some reason, that kind of sticks. Now, first of all, he did go out of line of sight for years because he was in prison for a long time. And having that kind of hint that maybe he passed away, it would sound like that for a long time. I mean, it would make sense that he's gone because he's out of the limelight completely.
But of course,
but he didn't die. He's now here. We know about him.
Like, well, he's passed now.
Passed now, but we came out of prison.
And we remember that really well.
Right. Became the president, like the whole deal. Like he was a major factor again. But there was a point of time where people thought he died.
There's a point of time that people swear he died and don't recognize his later life.
And wait, what do you mean don't recognize his later life?
They don't recognize it. They created this term called the Mandela effect. And what this is supposed to represent is the idea that if a lot of people have the same memory of something that it's in dispute, it must be true from an alternate reality, from an alternate universe. Kind of crazy,
wow.
Right?
Wow.
Okay. So
wait, their thought is – okay, the general concept here, of course, is when you do time travel or interdimensional stuff, if you're in the wrong universe, big things can slightly be different, right? That whole idea of parallel worlds ideas. And so their thought is that, oh, this is actually taking place all the time. We don't recognize it very well. And Nelson Mandela's an example. He did die for some people. And for some people, he got out of prison, became president, and then died.
And these people that thought he had died recognized at one point that they were in the wrong universe. They have a different memory than everybody else does.
Okay.
Yeah, so, yeah, we're getting a little sci-fi here, right? But this is an actual thing that was put forward at the same time as this Berenstain Bear conspiracy theory.
So I'm taking it that the book was never changed. Its name never changed. So there's no record in this universe of its name ever changing.
Exactly. If you look at photographs or old copies of the Berenstain Bears, it is consistently had the same spelling all the way through.
Okay. What is the spelling? Now I got to know.
This story is so deep that I have so many notes. I'm getting lost in finding the Berenstain Bear note. I believe it's spelled with an A instead of an E. And yes. So people remember it as bear, B-E-R-E. B-E-R-E is the false way to spell it. B-A-R-E
is the way it's spelled.
Is the way it's spelled on the
covers. So pretty subtle difference.
Yeah. And you know, people are using their memory to argue this. Yeah. But when they actually look for evidence, there's only one line of evidence that can be found. So because of this—
Can't we just accept— – I mean, can't we just— – you and I can agree pretty clearly that memory is extremely fallible. And we know that—
– Okay. Fallible? So fallible. Yeah. So same as our language. So we've all had times where we have argued a point and we were absolutely sure we were correct. And we argue this to the point where somebody finally brings out some bit of evidence that finally we have to conclude, wait a second, maybe I was wrong.
Right.
My wife will tell me this happens all the time. But
it's easier when it's a shared knowledge of lots of people and like maybe a Wikipedia entry around it, right? Because at least you don't feel like you're alone in your correctness.
So we've seen articles and studies for years about how fallible memory is, and we know this. So when we hear these things, we're instantly thinking, yeah, people are just relying on their memory and they don't believe they can be wrong.
Right.
But the interesting thing is to look at how much that they go down this road. So after this Mandela effect was talked about in relation to the Berenstain Bear conspiracy theory, these same people over here that remember the Shazam movie grabbed a hold of this. And
wait,
it took off
saying,
like wildfire.
Are you saying that there's actually a correlation between three different things in our history and it's the same people that are having that experience? Or is it like, wow, I remember that Shazam movie. And then later, like, yeah, remember Nelson Mandela died? Yeah, I think I do remember that. Like, is it that the same people have the same memories, or is it just different groups and sometimes they correlate?
No, what I'm saying is this concept is becoming so real for enough people that when they hear it in relation to one thing, they're applying it to something else.
Mm-hmm.
So these people that vaguely remember the Shazam movie started congregating on a Reddit thread. And the kind of things that they're talking about here just are fascinating to me because they're absolutely sure they have these memories. And I want to go through a few of them because the reveal later is kind of important. So there's people who are saying it doesn't really exist anymore. It existed at the time and to me and others, but something took it away. Any trace of it except for our memories of it is gone. Trust your memories. And somebody else writes, it's a conspiracy. I swear this movie exists. And
so let's see if people remember the movie.
Okay. Well, so there was a poster that these people on this thread started talking about that they remembered. They remembered a poster that had Sinbad. You remember the stand-up comedian,
sure.
Sinbad, yeah. And it said Sinbad in big letters and it dwarfed all the other print. And Sinbad posed on the cover. He was facing left, his arms crossed and his eyebrows raised. It had a purple background. All of these are memories from these people that remember Shazam.
So they were talking about this movie Shazam, and they're like, I remember this Shazam movie and Sinbad was in it. And then other people were like, oh, yeah, I remember that too. It had a purple background. Like there was a collaboration of like, where'd that movie go? And they're all trying to find it.
Right. They're all discussing it. They're all looking for evidence and they're all bringing up their memories. And it's feeding off of each other. And they have license that maybe this Mandela effect actually is what explains why they can't find evidence because they are all remembering something from an alternate reality.
It's a horrible reason. I kind of love that reason, but it's horrible.
Well, the funny thing is they get to the point where they're tweeting at Sinbad and he's replying with,
of course,
you know, I've noticed that no one my age seems to be called, or I'm sorry, I've noticed that no one my age has seen this so-called Sinbad genie movie. Only you people who are kids of the 90s, mind you.
Ah, interesting. So the kids of the 90s remember it, yeah, but nobody that's like an adult in the 90s remembers it.
Yeah, there's a certain segment of people. And he's saying, I must have played a genie because everyone else says I did.
So he's accepted it?
Well, no. He's just saying that if everybody else says he did, he must have done it, right?
Right.
Even if he can't remember
right,
it.
Right, of course.
So the what's funny about this to me is if any of this sounds familiar to you, if there's something tickling your brain and you're trying to remember it, there was a movie, and these people are fully aware of it. And it was called Kazam. And I know about this movie because it's actually something that I worked on. And
What?
Yeah.
Kazam was a movie you worked on?
The first film I ever did any effects for was this movie called Kazam. And everything that they're describing tangentially or exactly describes something that is in that movie.
Okay,
or on that poster.
That's fantastic. I did not know that you were going to talk about this, that you worked on it. So what's Kazam about? Who's in it?
Well, Kazam is starring Shaquille O'Neal as a genie. Just like Sinbad was supposed to be a genie.
And they're both black men with bald heads.
Yes, indeed. And they both are supposedly in their films helping out one or two kids who are about 12 years old. You know, it's not
great. Is it a good movie? What'd you do on the movie?
It's not a great movie, but some people remember it fondly. There's this giant scene at the end where the genie has to save
spoiler
the
alert.
Child. Yeah, spoiler alert for a 25-year-old movie.
Whatever. You haven't watched it yet.
where a genie has to save the life of this boy, and he kind of goes into this Buddha head, glowing light, things flying around thing.
I don't think I remember.
No, you won't.
No.
This was a very, very
small-time movie.
That's
so funny, because the same article I heard, they were talking about two other movies, and one of which you're also involved with.
Well, this is the thing. Especially in the 90s and the early aughts, it is common for Hollywood to come out with two movies, two different studios producing
totally.
A similar movie.
Wait, go back to the Shaq movie. Did you do that 3D scene where he's like in a dream sequence and things are flying around? Is that what you did on it?
Yeah.
How many animators were involved?
Effects people. Well, animators and effects people. You know, you're stretching back in my memory. I can't remember.
So therefore,
you're
going to give a wrong answer. Please, your wrong answer, please.
It was in the order of magnitude of 5 to 10 people.
I think that's fantastic that you actually worked on the film that these people are talking about. That's great.
But they know about that film and they
insist that Shazam
existed.
Their...
And it's partly for this reason that we all know about movies that compete with each other. There's Bugs Life and Ants came out at virtually the same time.
And you worked on one of those, right?
Actually, I didn't work on either one of those. I went to both studios that worked on those, the film after.
Ah, I see. There's
Turner and Hooch and K-9. There's Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and Robin Hood. These are all movies that came out from
right
different
on top
studios,
of each other.
Right on top of each other. Saving Private Ryan and the Thin Red Line, and Finding Nemo and Shark Tale. And I did work on one of those, and my wife worked on the other. So, yeah, it's not uncommon. I mean, their line of reasoning has some basis in things that we've seen.
Yeah.
Except for they're discounting the evidence that this movie never existed.
That's fantastic. And they're saying that the reason why that the movie never existed, but they remember it, is because they're actually from a different parallel world.
They have shared memories from a different reality. Or you could also look at this. I just showed my kids The Matrix. Mm-hmm. And you could also look at it that way.
Just a glitch in the system.
Yeah. In fact, one of these people points out, well, Neil deGrasse Tyson said earlier in this year that he thinks there's a 50-50 chance that we're in a computer simulation. So that's a good enough excuse for him.
You know the argument about the computer simulation?
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
It's similar to – isn't it – wouldn't you say it's similar to that there must be life somewhere else in the universe? It's the same kind of –
Yeah, I kind of understand what you're saying. It's like similar kind of reasoning that if you look at all the different variables and you push them a certain way, you can just assume that there's lots of other life in the universe. The Drake Equation, I think, talks about that
exactly.
Directly. But in any case, the one about the simulated reality, just since you brought it up, is the idea that at some point in time, most likely, we'll be able to simulate in computer systems pretty complicated universes. And if we are able to do that almost perfectly at some point, we'll probably generate a whole bunch of them to do testing and things on. And we'll do that for long periods of time. And if we do that, that means – and if in general a universe can emerge where there's a simulation that simulates universes, then you could just assume that most universes are actually simulated. Like it would make more sense that the majority of them are simulated if we could simulate them in the future. Because at some point in the future, let's say we simulate 6,000. Well, that's 6,000 simulated to one real. Assuming we're a real one.
Right.
That's
so
kind of
the odds
idea.
Are that we're in a simulation, and if you look at it that way. But weren't we just discounting the singularity just a couple episodes ago?
That was about artificial intelligence singularity. You don't have to have an artificial intelligence or a singularity kind of event to have a really good simulation of the universe.
Because you could set all this up with just basic rules that are all independently working off each other to create this reality?
We assume that's how it works right now. Yeah, it's a pretty complicated simulation, but I guess it's possible.
Well, I guess there is no intelligence behind it.
It really doesn't matter much whether we're simulated or not. I personally think that it doesn't make any sense because the complexity of the system is so great that how do you deal with a universe that contains another universe in it? At some point, the boundary of the simulation has to break, which means that we'll probably be able to discover if we're in a simulation or not, because at some point, some fundamental law would look weird. Now, some people will say, well, yeah, it does look weird, hence quantum movement and like the Planck's length. That is the simulation granularity, which makes sense. So, yeah, it's kind of fun to think about. It doesn't really change anything about how we live our world, you know.
So memory.
Memory is bad.
Memory is really bad.
I remember the story about investigation of memory where an investigator just asked people about an accident. And they slowly introduced this red car in the accident by saying things like, okay, so you were in this accident and was the red car across the street or the left? And the person the first time through says, there wasn't a red car. They go, oh, okay, I'm sorry, maybe you didn't see it. And then the next time they ask him again a couple days later, the same thing, and they say, where's the red car? And over about three interviews, the person places the red car as a major part of the accident. And it never existed, clearly never existed. And this is really easy to do to somebody. So if you ever want to have somebody remember things, and I do that with my kids sometimes just for fun, just slowly introduce slight reality change and they'll take it up and own it. It's really fun.
And that's exactly what a researcher from the University of Washington Department of Memory, I think I got that right, he refers to studies like that describing how these people online in this Reddit group are actually changing each other's memory as they talk about this.
Right. That would make sense. And that's interesting because this Yahoo group and then the Reddit group that did this, you actually have logs of it, right? Because you've got a historic
link. Well, it's still online, yeah.
Right.
The evidence for the movie is bad, but the evidence for the discussion is clear.
Does that mean in the discussion you see people changing their opinion and taking on a new strength? I mean, because you can analyze the entire flow of the meme, if you will, of this idea, what this assessment of the movie. The thing I think is funny is that the actual movie with Shaq in it has a purple background and he's crossing his arms. Why would both movies have the same background? Like you take Ants and Bug's Life. Ants has a different color set and color theme than Bug's Life, right? They're just different.
They had
movies.
Different designs, although there were so many similarities. You're going to see the similarities before you see the differences because that's how we're made to see the world. We're trying to match patterns.
I think I liked Bug's Life. I don't think I liked Ants very well. Or was
Typically.
It the other way around? Which one was the circus?
That was Bug's Life.
So Bug's Life was Seven Samurai.
Exactly.
Which, is, of course, is a famous Kawasaki film. Whose film is that now? I don't know.
Kawasaki.
No.
No. Not Miyazaki.
But there's also the Western that's based off the same thing.
Exactly. Which is escaping me.
I wasn't planning on Kurosaki. Miles chimes in with Kurosaki. Thank you so much, sir. Any case, this, of course, is about a town that's overrun by bad guys and this group of bandits in Seven Samurai that are actually Ronin, I think. They're roaming samurai without land. And so they're kind of disgraced, but in any case, they come in and help anyway. Same with the Western, which Miles, of course, is telling me right now is not something he's telling me about. What is it?
Well, the moral of the story is the masses can win if they just combine and...
Right. And so
and
in a bug's life,
to the, authority.
The bugs are able to overpower the
grasshoppers,
which are evil. What's the ants plot?
I've been trying to remember the name of the famous actor-director who is the voice actor in Ants and is centered around him, and I can't remember it.
Kurosawa, by the way. I'm not saying Kurosaki. It's Kurosawa.
Thank you, Miles, for finally getting our pronunciation correct.
He corrects us even when he's not here. Fantastic. Anyways, bugs, ants, not so important. The point is that...
Well, no, ants was a great film as well. It had some wonderful visual things to it that wasn't being done anywhere
like
else.
Like what? Like water?
Well, no. I remember the rendering on it had a softness to it when... The first computer graphics full-length feature movie, Toy Story 2, was about toys for a reason. Because you can do shiny plastic objects much easier than you can do organic objects of made out of different materials. Bug's Life had some very rich textures and richness to it, but it was still rigid body ants that
kind of have an exoskeleton that doesn't move very well.
That doesn't deform so much. Mm-hmm. And it has hard edges. If you look at the characters, they've got hard edges to them. Ants, for some rendering techniques and the way they did it, it actually had a softness to it, which I thought was really great. It did not feel like your typical computer graphics. It didn't feel like it was plastics or plastics with a really nice texture on it. It was something a little bit different. Okay. And it was all comes down to the rendering technology that they built at PDI, which then was bought by DreamWorks.
Okay, something I feel like we should... Do you want to talk more about memory, or we can move on to something else?
Well, no, I just want to bring it back to fake news and just say that this is the kind of thing that's going on in social media all the time when people are sharing these articles. They're not necessarily remembering the details, and they're especially not always looking for the source. It's something I've always kind of prided myself on, is trying to remember the source of the information. And when I can't remember the source of that, I treat it differently than the information I can remember the source of.
That makes sense. That's one way to try to help you along with whether your memory's changed or not.
Right.
Because if you remember the source, at least you can look it up again and you kind of have a little bit more a reality check to some degree.
And that gets me into something which I have not fully explored, but I'm going to bring it up here just because it is exactly on point. There is a class that's being put together. I'm trying to find the school. The instructors are Carl Bergstrom and Javin West, and the title of this class is Calling BS in the Age of Big Data.
And that BS is actually expanded in the title.
I'm assuming. Oh, sure. If you want to search for
cool.
it. Cool. this is exactly what I think our entire society needs to start looking at, is how do you actually figure out what has value and what should be ignored.
And this is a class they're offering? A free class?
Yeah, this is I'm sorry, I am not seeing the it's University of Washington. Yes.
Okay.
And it's got sections that are about things like spotting BS and the natural ecology of BS and what is the casualty of BS and statistics and how you can look at statistics to judge whether something is BS.
Nice.
And
sounds like a good class.
Yeah. So I'm going to research this. Maybe we'll talk about it a little bit more later. But there's a lot here. It's a full syllabus with references that is something that I think we all need to look into more these days.
So we mostly use Macintosh machines at work. I, of course, do iOS development, as do you. So, of course, we're iOS or Mac users.
Sure.
Because you can't really do development on iOS without being a Mac. But, you know, a couple years ago, I started seeing that at some point Windows is going to become kind of a kick. It's going to get its steam back up. It's going to do a good job because you can kind of rest on your laurels in some way when you're the leader of the pack. And in Silicon Valley, mostly OS X or Mac OS is kind of the leader of the pack. At the same time, there are a lot of developers here at Netflix, for example, that use Windows machines and a lot of Linux machines users. And in general, the disappointment that you and I have both heard about the Apple's investment in Mac OS has kind of starts questioning whether it might be at some point time to make your major machine be a different operating system. It's something that's possible. This week, a buddy of mine did that. He went ahead and switched from Mac to Windows machine, and the hardware is just superior in every single way. It's got all the ports. It's got a touchscreen. The entire surface is a touchscreen. My new laptop has a little row of keyboards that's a touchscreen, right?
What sort of machine are we talking about here? A laptop? Or?
It's a laptop Windows machine. It's got 16 gigs. He didn't pay for the Pro because he wanted a thinner one. It's heavier than my MacBook Pro, but in every other way, his machine is superior. Except for maybe it's running Windows 10.
Okay, go on.
Okay, but at the same time, Windows 10 has had this Windows subsystem for Linux in it, and this is it's called WSL, and this basically allows some things to run kind of like a Linux environment. And one way of thinking is like Bash, the born again shell for Linux, which is kind of the default command line interface, exists in Windows at some level. And Windows has been rolling this out and kind of increasing. It came out really, really, really recently in the full release. But it's there now, which means that if you're liking OS X because of its Linux underpinnings, or its Unix underpinnings, I should say, liking Windows for that could also be something that occurs. Like, this is a major step in my view of how you could move forward and be on a Windows environment. An example of this is years ago when I first started getting excited about Node. A lot of the discussion about Node's real acceptance in the corporate environment was, can you run it easily on Windows? And the Node core team and other people in NPM focused heavily on making sure that Node was such a great experience on Windows environment as well. And they did a lot of work to make that happen. And
As somebody who has followed command line utilities that you can download and or compile and run on a Mac or Linux, it's common to see supported on Mac and Linux and less support on Windows, if there's any support at all. But there's always been a way to run these command line utilities on Windows, hasn't there?
Yeah, you can always do Wine. That's Windows on Linux. It's kind of opposite. So no, it's not been an easy environment to be in. You just do things differently on a Windows machine, right? You'll have an install script, a bat file that will actually set up your environment the way you need to make sure that Node is an executable, for example. And then, yeah, you can pass parameters to executables, and so you can do that. Like, it's not that different in some regards. But the piping capability and the tie-up, the way that Unix actually functions, hasn't worked fluidly. It's definitely moving, from my perspective, moving in the right direction. Is that a good way to describe it?
Sure. Okay. So we haven't talked much on the show. We've alluded to it a couple times. But yeah, there are people that are absolutely disgusted that in the Mac world, they can't just go out and get the hardware that they want, because in the pro machines, there's like the Mac Pro hasn't been updated in 3 years. So you're saying your friend did this, and what was his verdict?
Well, so he just did that today.
Okay.
Yeah, it just happened to correlate with this Windows article of a couple days ago. And to be clear, the way you can always, of course, run a virtual machine inside a machine, right? So especially in a Windows environment, if you run Linux, you just spin up a virtualized Linux, which means that the main operating system is running another operating system in a virtualized context. This is just how any of our virtual boxes work. In fact, the entire infrastructure of Netflix runs on virtual machines hosted by Amazon, right? So there's hardware boxes that has a lot of resources, and they spin up these little virtual instances, and we, you know, buy those instances from them and use them for our pleasures. And they look like computer instances, OS, but they're actually virtualized. So it's just a level of abstraction. And you can do that with Windows. And in fact, because Windows hardware is cheaper and has better, you can get RAM at a higher level.
Right. If you get 32 gigs of RAM, then you're feeling constrained.
Right. You have some problems regarding 64-bit versus 32-bit operating systems, and there's some confusion there and some things that are difficult. But in general, you can just do that. But that's not how Windows this new system from Microsoft is working. They're actually running a Linux kernel interface that talks directly to the NT kernel. The Windows is actually built still on NT. Remember Windows NT?
Mm-hmm,
that
sure.
Stands for New Technology. Yeah. Not a great name. That's actually still the kernel level thing. In any case, it's running and talking directly to the kernel. So it's an ambitious endeavor of Microsoft's.
So they made an API that directly translates the calls to the NT kernel, so that you can download any Linux tool. Well, what is there? There's a bazillion flavors of Linux. So most of the tools compile on most of the Linuxes, I would say. But any one of these that you can download that wasn't intended for Windows is going to be able to compile and run on it?
I wouldn't say that, because I don't know if you read up on that, and that's your analysis.
No, I'm asking.
I'll just do. That
would be my assumption, the way you were talking about it.
So here's a closing note, an amendment to the article that I'm reading from InfoWorld, and that is that Rich Turner, a senior program manager at Microsoft, noted on Twitter that Bash/WSL, they're calling it Bash for Windows or WSL, is not a Microsoft Linux distro. In fact, WSL is designed to be distro agnostic. We currently run a standard Ubuntu distro and aim to support other distros in the future.
Okay, so this is really low level.
Effectively, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's very low level. You could, yes, totally low level. So in any case, I'm excited to see how this goes forward. And of course, we'll probably cover this more as we move forward in our program.
But then you have to buy Windows.
Yeah, but, you know, it's going to be cheaper.
So, okay, why do you use the Mac over Windows or Ubuntu or any Linux desktop?
Because at the fundamental level, why it felt so good to move to a Macintosh when I did.
It's probably in 2005?
Yeah, maybe around then, maybe a little earlier than that.
2005 to 2008? No, you
said
earlier.
Did
you ever have a PowerPC Mac?
Yes. I grew up with a Mac we grew up the VIC-20, and then after that, like an electronic keyboard for serious work, and then a Mac Plus. Or Mac 5, maybe we had a Mac 512 and then a Mac Plus. So I've been with a Mac since the beginning. And then when I went to college, I bought a Performa, which was another Mac. And then I went into a Windows environment heavy when I started doing software development and hardware and such. And then in about 98, I became a web developer. And as a web developer and designer, I needed a lot of tools, and I was kind of on both platforms. I was on a Mac, a Power Mac of some sort. Doing, you know, Flash and Adobe product stuff, and also had a Windows machine, but it was mostly Mac for a while. Then I switched back to Windows again heavily, so I've kind of toggled multiple times in my career. But for the last, I would say the last 15 years, heavily only Macintoshes. And the reason is, because I'm a web developer, whenever you're actually running a web service, unless you're hosted on a Windows machine, which has a license fee related to it, or a Macintosh server has a license fee related to it, if you're running a web server, you're normally running it in a Linux environment because there's no license fee on it. And so in doing that, when you set up the server and you configure and all that, you have to do via command line, and that's a Linux environment. And as you start kind of being in that environment comfortably, having that available on your primary machine is kind of like it's de facto has to happen. It's like it's insane not to have it. It is the power piece of the machine, if you will.
So once Mac OS X came out and it had most of the same subsystem that Linux expects,
yes,
and could run all the same tools that you could find on a Linux server. Most of the same tools.
Yeah.
Once it got to that point, you looked back at the Mac and said, okay,
that's when I jumped back in. Yeah,
that's way I'm, what my tool will be.
Yeah, OS X jumped me back in, definitely.
So
yeah.
It's taken Windows 17 years now.
Keep in mind what they're doing is totally different because they have an entire planet that's invested in Windows and everything around Windows and how Windows works. And they're trying to add on top of that in a non-virtual but semi-shared way another operating system. Because, you know, the reason why OS X, Mac OS, has Linux underpinnings is because it's a free BSD, or not free BSD, but a BSD derivative. It's a Unix core. That's what it was started as. And they built stuff on top of it. So it's not that it's like they added this stuff on later. It is the core of the infrastructure of the system.
No, technically Linux came along later.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. If you think
and
of the cousins
the,
aspect.
And it just replicated the kernel APIs enough that people were able to take the same tools and adapt them.
Totally. And so if you're extremely familiar with Linux environment, you can move to a Unix environment, OS X environment, and all the core aspects of like, how big is my file system? How do I find out what files are on here? Can I reformat? All those commands are all the same. And so
There's some differences on Mac that gets people, but sure.
There's totally more complications on Mac that are different than others, but all distros have that to some level. You can really think of OS X as a distro of Unix derivative.
Sure.
I mean, that's what it really is. So it's neat to see Windows move this direction, and at the same time seeing the hardware be cheaper, and also seeing Apple not seeming to invest the kind of resources in OS X and their hardware line of laptops as they are on iOS devices and watch and maybe a car in the future. Just seems like it kind of coalesces to, at some point down the line, Windows might be the machine to grab. So, you and I, though, we're totally stuck because we do iOS development. So
you could say that, but I'm happy in my jail if that's the way it is. We were talking about memory in a nonpartisan way. I'm completely a partisan when it comes to computer stuff. I've been on the Mac all along. And, of course, Windows didn't have Microsoft didn't have a motivation to make this easier for 20 years while they were trying to sell their own web server and their own web tools, mm-hmm, and their own GUI-based devices or GUI-based applications that would serve the same purposes that Linux grew up around serving.
Keep in mind, though, that Microsoft has also done something that's kind of – it's not something that Apple does at all. And that is Microsoft still supports everything they've ever done, right? Like they have this –
Well, they're starting to change that. They're trying slowly to change that. But yes, absolutely. And it's a monumental task.
They're also doing this thing of being – like, you know – Apple's very friendly with their developers. Like, come and develop on our platform. Here's a great conference, and here are all these wonderful tools. And, I mean, it's a really great environment to program on if you're playing the Apple game. But when you really think about what you're doing is you're developing stuff that works only on their systems. At least Microsoft has the Azure cloud, right? And in the Azure cloud, they're running Linux instances, and you can get space on their Ubuntu in their cloud. Like they're transcending just their operating system. Apple would never host stuff on somebody else's machines, right? I just don't see Apple doing that. In fact, you can't even really get Apple to host your stuff except for maybe a website, right? I mean, it's just a different way of interacting. Apple's very much, you're playing on our playground. Microsoft's like, here's all these tools and, you know, pay our license fee.
Right, right.
Do anything you want, just pay us a little bit of money. So it's a different, type of company.
Absolutely. And for those few people who have tried to turn Macs into servers that you could use the Apple frameworks, it's been really hard and slow, and it's not common.
I did that a lot at university, because in the arts division where I worked for like 11 years, we ran Macintosh. Almost everybody had Macintosh laptops. It was a lot easier for the small admin stuff we had. And because of that, we ran web servers. At the time, of course, Macintosh had X-Serves. They were hardware level designed for server rack mount, one U rack mounts. And we bought a lot of those, and we had hardware of theirs, and we ran all OS X kind of environments. And it was really quite nice. And then I started running a program that was a digital arts program, and I had students working on interesting projects like scraping all of C-SPAN's video footage and making it open source and removing the trademarks because it's actually filmed by government officials and therefore it's in the public domain. And so those kind of projects. And of course, I didn't put that on a Mac OS system. I got Linux boxes for that, right? Because the truth is what I was using on top of that was Apache and all these open source tools, which the operating system can just be any Unix derivative. And of course, Linux is a lot cheaper than running a Macintosh hardware-based solution.
Yeah, so, it much cheaper, much more readily available. And of course, at home, whenever I set up file servers or the web servers, I've always done that on a Linux machine, except for I did do a mail server on a Mac for a while, but I gave that up because it was too much
pricey.
Work.
Yeah, it's too much work. Yeah.
But so the reason why the Mac is an exciting platform to develop for, though, is different than the reason why these other operating systems are used for servers.
Right. The UI of the Macintosh operating system is great. I mean, I'm very comfortable in it. I love it. And when I tried to switch to Ubuntu a few times, and you know, every once in a while I tried to switch to Ubuntu, because I had these powerful Windows machines, I didn't run on Windows anymore, I switched to Ubuntu, it didn't stick. You know, the first machine I built out for my son was an Ubuntu machine, and I taught him how to use Minecraft on it, and it did feel kind of, you know, it felt good for him for quite a while, and he got used to it. But it doesn't have the kind of ease of use that a machine uses. I mean, I love the iPad when I just want to do something, because I don't have to think about anything about it. You know, the login's the only complicated part of PDFs of it. And my OS and my laptop, you know, it's a little more complex. You know, I'm going to be having to find the thing I want. I'm having a lot of things run. There's a little more complexity. I can't say much critique about Windows, because I've not used Windows in a real manner since Windows 7. And so it's been years since I've really been a committed Windows user. But I think the reason why I stick with the OS, the Macintosh, is because of the operating system's GUI. It's a pretty GUI. I mean, that's what it comes down to. What about for you?
Well, I think it actually goes a little bit deeper than that. There's a software developer named Graham Lee. He's from the old Next days, programming on Next computers, and then later the early Mac days. And he develops on all sorts of platforms. But he had a great article where he was talking about in the early days of Next and then the early days of Mac OS X when it adopted, when it was born out of the Next operating system. The promise there was that there was going to be this one object-oriented language that was going to spawn these really consistent frameworks, these libraries mm-hmm. that all work the same way, with the same methodology built into it. And at the bottom of it, well, there was Unix, but they were going to hide as much of the Unix as possible because it was all built on these really modern, object-oriented, beautiful APIs, and trying to make the past, make the old ways of doing things that tended to be complex and confusing and inconsistent, that would eventually get buried beneath this beautiful system. And for the most part, that has existed for a long time. And we've gotten to the point now where the operating system is so old and has reached the point of inconsistencies, as it's brought in other technologies, that he started looking for other operating systems. And he compared all of these Unix and Linux operating systems to try to find his ideal one. And everywhere he went, he saw these inconsistent, poorly connected technologies and languages and APIs that he is sad that the purity of this idea is gone.
So this is Graham Lee's article. We'll have it in the show notes and actually on the podcast reader of your choice right now. If it's advanced enough, we'll actually have a link directly to it. But of course, the operating system you're talking about from Next is what or the language you're talking about is Objective-C.
Right.
It was the object-oriented cousin to C++, which is also an object-oriented programming language. Cousin in the sense that they're both object-oriented, derived from C. I mean, that's
okay,
all I'm
claiming. Okay, I'll let that
the
one lie.
Objective-C's patterns have an elegance to them, definitely. They also have like core security problems.
Sure.
And so there are – and of course, I'm an Objective-C developer, and you are Swift developer, and in the same – we're both using iOS. And that's the next stage, right? It's getting rid of Objective-C and actually going to another language. This idea that – and I got to read Graham's article, but this idea that it's all going to be perfect and roses just seems to me like a naive idea. I don't think we're ever going to get to a point where like, yeah, that's the answer. That's the best programming language. Like that doesn't exist.
Well, it wasn't just about the language. It was about the libraries and APIs. And anybody who's tried to program, there is a million languages out there, and then each language has a collection of libraries or frameworks that are sometimes not written the same way. So you can't just sit down and understand the methodology and just start coding. It takes quite a bit of research to understand the methodology for this library or that framework. And the promise of Next and later macOS 10 was that you would have this beautiful consistency that would make that easier. And, of course, when development's easier, you get better applications and you get less buggy applications. And,
sure.
And of course, at the UI level, the Mac has always been known for its consistency in its user interface, which would, in the perfect ideal, be all the way down the stack into the kernel, would be wonderfully organized. And what I wanted to close out with was, software development is so hard and takes so long that by the time you get to that point, techniques have changed or people have come up with other ideas. And just inherently over the, at least 30 years since Next was first worked on, that's a lot of age and a lot of cruft that builds up.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep consistency through that entire time.
It's really interesting because, of course, Apple, when they released iOS, they started a new operating system and they also produced a whole bunch of new libraries that did very similar things to their old libraries. So there are frameworks in Macintosh development which do not exist in the iOS environment. And iOS environment's actually a little bit, I would say, better and cleaner. If you go from working in iOS, you step into Macintosh development, it's definitely a paradigm shift, I am told. I've tried to do some things like screensavers and such and completely get lost in the Mac environment. It's just a little cruftier, if you will. I guess what I'm saying is that this idea that there is some future place where everything will work really well and easy, I just see that things get more and more complicated and our abstractions get greater and hardware gets faster. Like that's kind of the truths, right? I don't think it ever gets easier to develop as a programmer. And I think that that belief of mine comes from this idea that it feels like the boundary of the complexity of the system is the human mind, and the human mind's just not getting much better. Like, there's some smart people and not so smart people, but people get in software development are, you know, get hired, you know, do this profession. They're putting their brain at the boundary of how people can think in these abstract ways. Maybe the tools and techniques are getting so much better that we can write better software because of these things that get, you know, slowly over time.
Well, surely you look at the complexity of the software we're using nowadays. If you had shown that to somebody 20 years ago, they'd just be floored and amazed.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, we have had progress building on each other over the years.
All right. I'll have to read Graham Lee's article. Definitely. Awesome. You actually – that's all the stuff we had linked to today's show.
And
I've been
more.
Wanting to – what's that?
And some more.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about a spoiler thing. Because I've been really interested in talking about the most recent Star Wars movie. So we're going to do that in the post show. We're going to talk about that. And if you haven't watched that movie, don't listen to what we're going to talk about. So for now, I just want to say that GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. As GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like it. You can even make money off it. Just give us some credit. I want to thank Michael Newman of Pet Star Music for our theme song, and also Greg Merkley for giving us the Rendering BS on Windows title of today's episode. And of course, today's episode is episode 2 of season 17. In the newest film from the Star Wars franchise. This is a spoiler alert. Stop listening.
Stop listening. Although I just had to pull up all of my Star Wars tweets. So this will be fun.
We haven't actually – have you seen it twice yet?
No, I haven't. Do you got it back to it?
I haven't seen it yet. a second time. And I really want to see it a second time. I thought maybe you and I should do that. But one of the things that I'd like to talk about is the uncanny valley aspect of the end of the film. Actually, in the middle of the film, Grand Moff Tarkin, is that the who comes back as a digital
Grand
form?
Grand Moff Tarkin?
Moth Tarkin?
Of course, I'm gonna get that
Miles will probably correct us in just a second.
Where is he when you
this
need
is,
him?
This is, of course, this actor died years ago, and it's Grand Moff Tarkin.
Moff.
Grand Moff Tarkin. And this, of course, is the Miles says he – or Greg says he saw it again last night. This is, of course, this high-level general of the
of the Empire.
Empire. And he's evil, and he dies in one of the first three films. And in this film, we see him – and, of course, this is a prequel to the first film, the New Hope film. And we see him – in that film, acting out a part, a relatively large part, and it's not a human being. It's a digitalized human being. And you and I, and I'm assuming your wife, who's an animator, were just looking at the technique.
I
never looked at, like, the scene. In fact, I don't even remember what he said because I'm thinking, why'd they do this?
Yeah, and that would be the biggest argument for somebody not to have done this, which for people that – I mean, for any deep Star Wars fan, they know that the actor does not exist anymore. So staring at somebody who they know couldn't be acting the part, it's going to pull them out of the film.
But was that the problem of the non-acting?
There's many layers here.
Okay. So when we first see him, we see him from behind and you see his bald head and low count of hair and you can tell it's his shape of him, and then you see a slight reflection in the glass. And the slight reflection in the glass, I went, oh, cool, they digitized his face and they cut it from their – they pulled it in from some other thing. I didn't know how they were doing it, you know.
Right. You look at it and go, that's classy.
And I was
way you do it.
Right. That was exactly my take. It was like, that's perfect. I love it. And you can have a couple lines and they have some voice actor that can match his voice and we can't hear voices like we can see faces, so we're not going to tell.
And we fully expect that the rest of the movie will just have glimpses of him. Maybe a silhouette. Maybe another reflection. Maybe it's a hologram.
And then he turns around and has a soliloquy that just makes me want to vomit. Like, I was literally disgusted by it. Just like, ew. I mean, here's the thing. I understand the director saying, can we do this? Yeah, we can probably pull it off. Doing some mocks. You know, we're really good at this now. We can totally do this. Okay, let's do this. And I can understand them spending tons of time animating this. I can understand tons of this. Get this.
I want to back up and say, the filmmakers that did this surely did not know whether it could be done. But they said, we're going to try to do this.
Yes, and I support them saying that. I think that's great. And I totally love that they attempted it. And I'm assuming at some level I don't know if it was completely in a virtualized set. It looked really virtualized to me, but it's probably in a green screen. There's probably was a body double to move out the actor to do the interactions. You kind of want like base footage to work off of, as Melanie can talk about quite a bit about the Lord of the Rings films. She worked on
Gollum. Yes.
Gollum. And Gollum, of course, is a completely generated character, which had footage of the actor, the voice actor, and actually the person that's given credit as the actor, even though there was a lot of animation work on it. So I understood having like base level footage. And so because you have base level footage and you have to overlay kind of a digital rendering mask, maybe you're a little more stuck on lighting controls and stuff or changing the scene afterwards. But my general take is you render that whole thing, you see it. You're an expert filmmaker who's made tons of amazingly cool films, and you simply say, nope, that's not ready. That's what should have been done. They should have said, no, that's not ready.
But of course, we watch the rest of the movie, and there's scene after scene where he comes back, and he does. I mean, some of those some of those renderings, 30-second long shots of this digital double. I call it a digital double. That's the old term. He's not a double. He's the main character of that scene.
He is the main character of that scene.
Okay, but now we saw this with a number of other people who are not filmmakers.
That was the amazing thing about it. People I totally respect and love.
Okay, so we saw the movie together and we saw it with friends. And some of these friends are not longtime Star Wars fans. In fact, some of them would never have seen it unless they came with us.
So David, for example.
Yes.
Did he notice? Did he care?
I don't remember David.
But, yeah, I've got to talk to him about it.
Al did not recognize that.
He didn't even know it was digital.
No, nor his wife. So they certainly reach a level that a certain number of people are going to see the film and not even think about it.
And if most people are not going to see it And that was the rationale. Okay, first of all, the filmmakers, they saw it. They know, right? Like, there's no way you get into a position not recognizing that that doesn't look right.
Okay, yes, good filmmakers, they're going to show it to people, they're going to get feedback and all that. At the same time, when you work on something for 2 years, when you've worked on, I mean, some of those shots, they were started in the beginning of the show. They probably did not get finished until the last week of the show because there were so many iterations. And if you look at something over and over and over again, you know you can't trust your own opinion. So you have to show it to other people. Well, depending on who they show it to, they're going to get reactions of like, that's amazing. You got to keep that in there.
The only reason it's amazing you got to keep it in there is that it's a stage of our ability to do it. It's a stage in our evolution to do it. Eventually, every eye will not be able to see it. Like, we will get to the point where you will not know if it's an actor or not. And, you know, some people say they saw – what was the movie about the train?
Yeah, yeah. That was Midnight – no. Goodness gracious.
Miles, Greg, going to help us with the title of this film?
Not the Christmas
The Train?
Express,
no, something train. Express.
Polar
Express. Thank you, Greg. So in the Polar Express, some people were like, wow, it was kind of wrong, you know, slightly different. And I'm like, what? No. The entire thing was animated. Like, there was no point at which I was like, is that real or not?
Right.
But some people are like, wow, that was like real.
Right. And some people look at Saturday morning cartoons and think, well, that was just as good as Disney back in the day.
Oh, right. Are you talking about like the bad animation of voices?
Oh, sure. I mean, there are people that just can't discern the difference.
And we're not critiquing that. In fact, it's probably better to live in that world where that Star Wars movie was perfect and it was amazing that they brought Leia back.
And it was... You had to bring up Leia.
Well, that's the worst one. You know? We're talking about... I don't even care about that character. I mean, I do. He's a great evil guy, right? But I didn't even know his name, right? But Leia coming back is just such this...
Did you see the announcement recently that they have said that the filmmakers are grieving as well and they will not do a digital remaking of Leia for future films because of the death of Carrie Fisher?
Okay, first, I'm mixed about that. Why? I mean, they did it to this.
I know.
That played Grand Moff Tarkin.
And everybody's going to be afraid that they're going to do it again, considering the same reaction we're having now. Okay, yes. So the funny thing...
Well, first off, I'm upset about that because they'll get better at emulating young Carrie Fisher if they work at it. Eventually, they can take the film we just saw and they can fix it so that you can't tell. That will happen eventually, and there's no reason not to do that.
Speaking of that, of all the remakes I am so excited for is when somebody actually goes back and remakes the first three parts of the story so we can finally make that episode of our life get erased by something decent.
That would be nice. By the way, Peter Cushing was the actor. And, of course, the argument is that he would not be upset because – I mean, he would not be upset because that actor did everything he would have done. I don't know. It's just a silly thing to do. And when you've taken the likeness of someone and you've recreated something with their likeness, it does not matter what the original person thought or whatever. It's your work. It's based off of them. And it might be a little disgusting to do that, but it's not a comment about them as a person. I mean, if I do a comic about a political figure, no matter how realistic I do that, that's my work about that person. It's not that person. So even though they look exactly like and some people can't tell them apart, I don't feel like there's an ownership of identity in that regard.
Well,
especially if you passed away.
In Hollywood, you can make contracts for any kind of things. And I'm sure there are actors now trying to get their likeness as a part of their contract to keep control over it. But
Peter Cushing, by the way, not Crushing. Peter Cushing.
I thought it was Cushing.
Cushing? Peter Cushing? Well, that's about pronunciation. But there is no R in it. So that's the important part.
Yeah. So... yes, they did contact, I believe it was his widow. It wasn't his daughter,
yeah,
was it?
No.
And they did get the permission
but the point
use his
for
likeness.
Me is that even when – okay, if you've been on a film where a scene took a lot of time, you rendered a whole bunch of this, all this work, and then they decided to cut it?
Let's take another
– Well, has that happened?
Okay, yes. Even in computer graphics, you don't want to do that. In animation, you don't want to do that, but it does happen. And it is part of the filmmaking process that you get to a certain point and you do cut things. And when you do that much work, I mean, the millions and millions of dollars that go into some of those shots, it's not something you want to cut, but it has been done.
And so why not do it there? And I think to say why not do it there is because all the filmmakers are like, the audience won't know. And I think they're right. But I want to know, Geekspeak audience, do you know when you saw Star Wars, and do not tell me you listened to this without seeing that episode. What was the most recent episode called? Rogue One. If you didn't see Rogue One and you're hearing my voice right now, I'm going to be so angry at you. But do email and let us know. Did you notice it? Was it a big deal? Or like, oh yeah, you noticed it, but the film didn't – nothing was reduced by the film. And that's the thing is I'm kind of blowing it out of proportion, right? I still love that film. I mean, I'm happy that it exists and all of those things. I just don't think they needed it.
And no, so no, you could have told that story with using all the techniques we're talking about, but there's another thing here. And John Syracuse on one of the other podcasts that we enjoy, he has a take, which is he comes at it from a different point of view. His point of view is someday films will commonly have digital actors. It's just going to be a common thing. Eventually, we're going to get to the point where the technology is so much easier and cheaper that filmmakers are going to want to use this technology to tell their story, whether it's going to be imitating the likeness of somebody that existed before or mm-hmm. whether it's making the perfect character that they can't find an actor for.
Right.
This is going to happen. We've been on this road for a long time. So somebody's got to try it, right? So you got to applaud the effort.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
if you get 80% of the people not even knowing what we're talking about, that's a huge win, right?
Yeah. Okay. So you're basically saying it's a giant audience test.
Yes.
Okay. We know you all hate 3D, but what do you think about rendered people in scenes?
So this is the other thing. The other thing that's notable about these last two Star Wars films is that the filmmakers have made a concerted effort to bring back the feeling of the original Star Wars by using practical effects and practical props and not filming solely on a blue screen stage set.
Yeah.
And so you can feel it. It really does feel like the Star Wars that we were excited about as kids. And then they throw this in to the middle of it, which is so at the other end.
Yeah. Okay, let me ask you another thing about the film. And this, again, spoiler alert. What do you feel about it being such a depressing, terminated storyline? How do you feel about that? Like, I mean, I left that theater like, yeah, what a great movie. And then you think about it, you're like, everyone in that movie dies. Okay. Eventually, everyone does. Even again.
Okay, so this gets at the root of why I didn't like the Carrie Fisher scene at the very end. Carrie Fisher? The Leia scene. That wasn't Carrie Fisher.
No. The Leia scene. Thank you very much.
When you get to the Leia scene, that was the moment they were trying to show the hope. She's smiling there, that we've got this hopeful thing. That was the beat that I wish wasn't there. So yes, everybody dies in a heroic, selfless act of trying to combat something that's truly evil, this empire.
And at the same time, their movement and activity and everything they did in that film is actually more impressive than destroying the Death Star in A New Hope.
Like, absolutely.
That's a more impressive storyline than the...
Well, yeah, because there was an event that you were talking about the
right.
whole time.
Yeah.
No. I mean, this was truly heroic stuff where it seemed like there's no way they're going to get out of this. And in fact... There was no way to get out of it. All they needed to get out of it was that little bit of information to set the storyline for the next film up. And I thought that was beautiful. What I thought was wrong about the Leia moment is that she should have been looking determined. She should have been looking like that. This was a horrible thing, but now we've got something that gives us hope.
Oh, I see what you're saying. The Princess Leia in that moment should have felt horrible. For at least a little bit longer, right? Everybody was on that ship destroyed. The planet's been destroyed. Like,
she knew what went into getting this thing that she now has,
right.
has in her
and there's
possession.
No emotion in her, like, loss of that moment. It's like, well, that movie's over. Let's move on. Instead of just taking the moment. Like, yeah, I don't know if an actor would have done that, right? Like,
what do you mean an actor would have done that?
I don't know.
That's
if
exactly what an actor does. An actor turns to the director and says, "You know,
you
you're telling me to do something,
that's
and that's not my character."
Right. I'm saying what an actor wouldn't have done. What that animated thing did.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And animators are actors.
Yes.
I'm married to one.
Yeah.
And they give feedback to the director all the time. But still, in this case, something was lost. The director didn't get challenged. The beat of that film.
And also, of course, there's probably an actor representing this, right? There's the voice actor, obviously. But there's probably an actor totally representing this. I'm assuming that Carrie Fisher didn't actually voice it. They didn't try to change her voice. She didn't act that scene, I'm assuming, at all.
I haven't looked into
but
that.
But in any case, there's probably an actor there. But the other part of that is because the actor is like the second-class stand-in citizen, they don't have the same kind of, you know, power as a traditionally acted character, right? They are being replaced by a digital thing. So in any case, I just wanted to do a couple feedbacks from people that are on our back channel, and that is that Pat mentions that Black Mirror Season 2, Episode 1, which is streaming on Netflix, by the way, has those lines of a character that dies and it's brought back to life digitally. And if you watch any Black Mirror yet?
I have. Which episode is this?
This is season 2, episode 1, is what I've told.
I've seen season 1 and season 3.
Yes. Confusing as that is, isn't it? Any case, Black Mirror is kind of Twilight Zone-esque and more contemporary themes.
Right.
And pretty dark. And I hear that it's hard to watch more than one a night. But I haven't seen any of them, except for...
Well, I guess... No, we watch multiple a night. I guess we're just... Well, I didn't mind everyone dying in Rogue One, so I guess I'm just a dark person, right?
Yeah. Do you really think that we'll get to a point where rendered actors will be just a lot cheaper and better than human stand-ins?
It's hard for me to believe that because of the process. I think what's fundamentally different about the process, and it's getting better, but in animation and in effects, there is just an incredible momentum to overwork something. The amount of time that goes into each minute detail, it's hard to keep a performance to be...
natural.
Not even natural, but to be... feel spontaneous, to inhabit the character in the way that actors try to do in their craft. It's possible. There's a lot of films that have done it. But when you're talking about replicating an entire actor, for now, it seems the process is going to get in the way, in my opinion. And I think you can see that in the Carrie Fisher, in the Leia example.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think they did a great job with Grand Moff Tarkin, even though I could see it and recognize that this was a digital recreation.
Yeah, it was really amazing. I mean, from a digital recreation, it was one of the best I've seen. And it wasn't as nearly as bad as Leia's acting. So it definitely felt good in the general sense. Like, there was nothing wrong with the performance, except it looked horrible to me. And again, I haven't seen it a second time to be able to look through, like, what's the dialogue like? What does it feel real that they're saying that? I was too stuck on how fake he looked. But let me just touch on something that you said, that digital scenes seem to be overworked. And that's a really interesting...
No, it's hard not to overwork them. It's something that the artists are always fighting against.
Yeah. I think of that in just general mediums. If you take like a watercolor medium that has a lot of looseness to it, and you just paint at a slightly quicker speed than you're used to, what you get at the end of that is kind of a neat side effect. You're like working with the randomness and the materials to produce something, and it's actually better than if you spend very detailed time doing something. There's something elegant that comes out of a loose quality rather than controlled quality. So when you're dealing with a system where every single thing has a handle you have to touch, that's a very difficult thing to get a flow from. Interesting.
Well, your original question was, do you think we'll get there? I don't think we'll get there where it's just going to be cheaper and easier to always use digital. But I think there will always be cases where a filmmaker will say, we need to do something that I just can't get an actor to do. And there's
someone who's passed away, for example.
Well, that's the obvious example. Gollum is a impossibly odd-shaped creature to put a human into a suit for. But there's going to be maybe performances. Maybe it's going to be such a distasteful thing to do. The actor, no.
Gollum for me was a more believable character than Tarkin. I mean, I felt like Gollum was more believable than that.
Of course.
Should I go back and look at Gollum and see how fake it looks?
Well, no, the difference there is that Uncanny Valley we were talking about. When you're used to seeing a regular human shape day in and day out, you're highly tuned to spot the oddity, anything that's not right. Gollum is not human. He's humanoid, and you forgive those oddities more easily without it being distracting.
He's alien, so it's okay he's alien.
Right, exactly, yeah. Which is the same reason why cartoons have worked for ages and so on. That's what the uncanny valley is all about, is that there's a point at which the realism you're trying to go for is so difficult that you are not going to be able to reach it, and it just looks odd to our senses. And as you said earlier when we were talking about this, you almost felt like you wanted to vomit or something.
Well, you know, the reason why I felt sick was not because it was making me sick, like a bad jump cut or something that was kind of like disquieting to my nervous system. It wasn't that, and my balance, it wasn't that. It was like, everything's been so great about this film. I'm loving this so much, and they just did this like They just spat on it for me. And that was really what it was
okay,
about.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially the Leia scene. That was just like, just don't show her face. Please don't show you showed the face.
Oh, look, it's smiling and beaming.
It would have been so great if they didn't show her face. And just from the back and go, no, is there ever, you know. And then her could have just be completely despair. You know, that could have been that moment where she breaks and is crushed.
Oh, that would have been great.
And then we know next scene when we see her again, she's going to be righteous and fighting, you know, Darth. That's okay. You could have just had her be despondent and crushed. That would have been fine. But instead.
But this is America.
No, it's not. It's a galaxy far, far away. Long time ago. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Brian Young. Thank you, Brian, for joining me today.
Yeah, it was a blast. Thanks for having me.